Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast, listener. We did fear it'd be too hot to do the podcast this week. It is very hot. If we were in the office, we would have our podcast chamber. Nice, cool, soundproofed podcast chamber, but we don't. And it is ridiculously hot. Recording this on Friday, 26th of June. Top line today, I'm going to talk about digital art. Caroline is working on a major piece about
the lasting impact that COVID-19 will have on the data centre industry and its status.
Cool. And Claire, I think you're chewing through a BCS report.
Yep, I'm looking at a BCS report that looks into diversity in the technology sector, specifically looking at age, gender, disability and ethnicity.
Cool, and more on that later. We're going to start with me today. I'm going to talk about digital art. So this week I interviewed a guy who is the CEO of an Israeli startup company. He's called Rob Anders, and the company's called NIO, N-I-I-O, and I've got a long explanation for why it's called NIO, which I can go into if you like. But it reminded me that a long, long time ago, this is podcast 3, I did a piece on a website called Watercolor World, which was all about digitizing already existing art, specifically watercolors. Although I think they were venturing into drawings as well. And part of the point of that was that with a lot of watercolors, you never see them because they're in drawers and museums and galleries and stuff. So it's a way of liberating those documents, putting them on the web, etc. And the other virtue, and I went to look at their website before coming on the podcast, they're still kind of saying this, it's like photographs for the pre-camera age. So the idea was you would have these people dashing off quick watercolors in various parts of the world fairly quickly, and that was a great kind of social and economic kind of documentary evidence thing. I think some skepticism was expressed on the podcast at the time about people dashing off watercolors as easily as you can maybe do a photograph today, but I thought it was a cool story. I quite liked it. The story's still there. This story is not about digitizing pre-existing art, it's about digital art, well, mainly about digital art. So this is a company which has a cloud-based digital art platform with a development team in the Ukraine. They've got 13,000 works and 4,000 artists on the platform. The idea is to connect artists with buyers of art, so museums, collectors, but also kind of institutions and companies as well, like hotel chains and airports and law firms and banks and things like that. And it's cloud-based. They're an AWS customer client, so it's based on AWS, the actual tech itself. And part of the idea is there are more and more digital artists. Rob mentioned William Kentridge, who I looked up quickly on Wikipedia. Seems a very impressive artist. But they have loads of them. Got 4,000 of these artists putting their work on the platform. And they're also, because of COVID times, a couple of things going on. One, they've made quite a lot of their art, or a significant part of it, downloadable as Zoom backgrounds and things like that. So I can include a link in the summary article to that. And they're also, you can download their app. I just did that earlier this morning. In fact, I think long term they're thinking that they could be like the Spotify of digital art. So you would kind of you would get digital art on your phone or on your tablet or your computer or whatever, but probably pay quite a big subscription for that. But their first kind of market is really things like hotels and galleries and museums and so on and so forth, where the art is delivered to super high definition display screens. And he's got a background in that. His co-founder's got a big background in art in Israel. So yeah, I thought it was an interesting chat.
The thing that kind of springs to mind on that is that it could bring in a new era of like art forgery, because you could screen grab the pictures on your devices, surely, and then just like, oh, I don't need to pay the subscription anymore.
This is where some tech comes in, because they have a blockchain.
Oh, everyone does. Yeah.
And the beauty of the blockchain in this instance is it creates a strong bond between the creator of the work of art and the artwork, and in everything that subsequently happens to it, like where it's sold to. And also they've got this lending idea that you can't afford like 120 grand for a piece of digital art. You could rent it, and you could rent, you know, have a subscription and rent different ones at different times and things like that. So yeah, and they have some, I'm sure they have some digital rights management technology going in there. But you've put your finger on the big issue, which is the reproducibility of art. And how do you get around that?
Well, it happens all the time on Instagram, doesn't it? People will screenshot other people's comics or artwork and then crop it so that the person's tag is cut out, and then say something in the summary like, oh, DM me for credit. And it's like, well, the credit was right there in the image, you just cut it out.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and that's part of the context against which they're trying to work. I mean, this may not work in the end, but it's in an age where anyone with a smartphone can do a bit of digital art and post away. So this is about ensuring the scarcity of the art that they host on their platform. And that's where the blockchain, as far as I can understand it, that's where the blockchain comes in. They have a way of ensuring scarcity, because that's where the value of art comes from. Mm. You're not going to pay £100,000 for something that anybody can just copy.
Do you think that it's going to sort of usher in an era of digital galleries, for example? So instead of having actual paintings, all of the galleries will be higher definition, yeah, like 4K TVs, and you can change the theme of a particular gallery at any moment. Because there's that, was it the Samsung Learning Centre that I went to go and see at the British Museum, which had sort of like, remember me on the Sphinx?
Mm. Yeah.
Had sort of like that interactive digital gallery where you could sort of interact with the exhibits, but in a different way than just looking at them. I wonder if that's, you know, like, could be fun for the future.
I'm actually thinking here in terms of being able to consolidate space. You could have a virtual gallery, like Claire said, but also combine it with like a Currys or something like that. So you've got a good high definition screen and have a like set a price tag next to that. Like, how much does it cost to get this telly that's like got a really clear picture as well? So I can see this being a money spinner, actually.
Yeah, warehouses.
Yeah.
The shop, but it's also a gallery.
Yeah.
So would you both quite fancy this then? If this sounds like I'm doing market research for you. Price, would you be prepared to pay for a subscription?
Yeah, and a 4K TV to look at it all on. Or I don't know.
Well, yes, indeed. But one of the things he said is all over the world there are these kind of massive high definition screens, and a lot of them are just switched off. They're not doing anything anyway. Mm. So if you could have some decent digital art available through them, then that would socially be a good thing. And he got onto this as the idea of rendering fine art in such a way digitally that you can add other content to it and put some context around it, and you could shoot it in a really beautiful way, so that in itself becomes like a work of art.
Just like Claire on the Sphinx that time.
Yeah, what a contribution to the art community.
And I think during this period that a lot of museums have tried to go more digital even than they were before. So I think the Courtauld's digital gallery is supposed to be pretty good. I was beginning to have a look at it this morning, but kind of ran out of time. There's a lot going on in that space. I was reading an art magazine the other day, to which I have a subscription, and I thought this might appeal to you guys. This is Apollo holding up, which is great for the podcast. An article called Vision Quest by Georgia Hazeldine. And she says, in April this year, the Getty released an art generator for players to upload chosen artworks from the museum's collection to Animal Crossing. Mm. So, wow. Yeah, there's a lot going on in terms of crossing over from digital video and gaming and virtual tours, and there is a lot of that going on, and it has been going on during this COVID period.
That's pretty cool though. You could own a digital picture of your favourite painting for your Animal Crossing house. Wasn't there that in one of the past Animal Crossing games there was that dodgy art dealer?
Yeah, he's back. He's turned off at my village at the moment.
That guy.
Like, trying not to have anything to do with him.
Mm-mm, so dodgy.
What do you guys think about kind of appropriating art that way? So I must admit, I'm looking forward to getting back to the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford and looking at some of my favourite paintings, one of which I've got a copy of. But I don't kid myself on that reproduction that I bought is the real thing. And it's not the same experience, me having a quick look at that while I'm having my spaghetti carbonara or whatever. It's not the same experience as standing in front of the actual painting in the Ashmolean.
Yeah, I was going to say, sort of along those lines, like one of the things when you do go to galleries is being able to see the, you know, the sometimes even like the brush strokes in just seeing how intricately it's all been put together. So you'd want, trying to reproduce that digitally is quite hard, like just getting that kind of, you know, immersive experience and stuff.
There is another thing I was thinking about in respect of that standing in front of the painting thing, which is, you know, because there is so much digital noise in our lives, we do get bombarded with digital stuff all the time. So the opportunity to have a like an analog experience, standing in front of a painting is just one example of an analog experience. Yeah, I did an interview earlier this week, it's a completely different thing, but with a young Cambridge academic called Johnny Penn. And he researches the history of AI, as it happens. But he was talking about the concept of decomputerization. You know, just saying there are areas of our life where we don't want digital, like the opposite of digital transformation.
Like, what kind of examples? Did he have any examples?
I think they were all kind of around nature and, like, not digitizing appreciations of environmental spaces and things like that. It was just a kind of a throwaway comment in the conversation. I like the word decomputerization. I mean, I suppose if we did a Google search on that, you might find that there's a whole bunch of people talking about, because these are not people who are technophobes. I mean, these are people who are very, very digitally savvy, know digital inside out, but they're still saying that, do you know what? There's just some areas of human life where it's better if it's analog. And that would be my example, would be standing in front of a painting.
I guess so. I think there are areas of life where it's better not to take your tech, like the toilet. But then, you know, sometimes you're out for a walk and it's actually quite nice to take a picture of a squirrel.
Yeah, no, my smartphone's been important to me during this period, taking lots of pictures of geese and ducks and stuff, things like that. Indeed. Yeah, there was an interesting conversation. I mean, I don't want to kind of put myself in the position of like marketing for this company, but I thought it was clustered around an interesting set of concepts around kind of digital art and whether you're digitizing pre-existing art or, you know, this whole new world, or relatively new world of digital art, because it's, you know, it's not just static images. In fact, it's mostly about video, short form video and things like that. Caroline, you're working on a massive piece.
Well, it's So this is a bit of a continuation of what we talked about on last week's podcast, where I told both you and Claire about how the COVID-19 pandemic has led to like huge spikes in the use of both business and consumer grade cloud services. And in line with that, we have heard sort of from some of the big hitters in the public cloud about sort of the important role, you know, their data centers have played in keeping the world online during this very strange time we're all living through at the moment. You know, even without Amazon, Microsoft, Google, etc., talking about this stuff, there have been signs recently that, say, governments across the world are starting to get more of a handle on just how important like data centers are to keeping the digital economy ticking over. And that is particularly true within the UK at the moment. The government has introduced a number of different measures since the onset of the pandemic to ensure the data centre industry can operate as normal and get its voice heard at the table on various sort of policy issues. And that might sound like a strange thing to say, but this is kind of unprecedented stuff. You know, having covered the data centre industry for more years than I care to count, there has been this sort of perception from within the industry that perhaps, you know, the UK government doesn't always really understand, you know, what data centres are, how important they are, or sort of give them maybe, you know, the credit they deserve as well. So it's things like reported loads of times in the past on sort of complaints that data center operators have raised, or sort of lobbying groups like Tech UK about how sort of, you know, new regulations come in around energy use or carbon emissions and stuff like that. And when it comes in, you know, either data centers are either overlooked within this legislation or policy, or they're unduly penalized by them because whoever set the policy doesn't quite understand what data centers are. And, you know, it boils down to, like, people don't understand data centers. If they did, they'd never pass something like this and penalize a market or an industry that does generate millions and billions of pounds each year globally, but also is an important contributor to the UK economy in terms of keeping it online, but also in terms of employing people as well. Some of the big changes that have happened recently are that data infrastructure staff are, as of March 2020, now classified as key workers, which in the context of the pandemic means that they can access childcare. So, you know, they can keep working. They don't have to worry who's going to look after their kids. They can keep going out to work if, say, for example, the government introduced even more stringent lockdown measures and impose stricter rules on who can travel where and stuff like that. And that particularly was down to the work of Tech UK. They've done a lot of lobbying on this. The other thing that's quite notable as well is, up to now, until the pandemic, the data centre industry in the UK has never had the backing or sponsorship of a single government department. But that has changed recently. DCMS have set up a data infrastructure resiliency team to ensure the industry has government level representation during the pandemic. And like I say, it seems a bit like, okay, so what? But like I say, this has never happened before. Usually, if, you know, something comes along that, you know, data center industry wants its voice heard on, it probably mean like, oh, you probably have to cozy up to maybe DCMS, or maybe it might be the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, or maybe it might be, you know, somebody else. So they've never really had a single point of contact they could go to raise issues on their behalf. And that has changed since the pandemic, because there is this realization now that if you overlook the data center industry, they are the ones keeping us entertained in the evenings and also ensuring we can all work during the day. So it's, yeah, this is quite a big shift. This team specifically is responsible for ensuring the needs and wants of the data center industry are factored in when decisions are made by the government about lockdown exemptions and things like that at the moment. They've been given funding for 12 months. So there's a little bit of a grey area of like, well, once we're out of the pandemic, who will be sort of speaking up for the data center industry within government after that? And that's still a little bit of a grey area. But yeah, I've been having chats with my contacts about these changes over the last few weeks. And yeah, the general consensus from the analysts and Tech UK and some of the operators as well is that they feel like COVID-19 has led to a genuine sort of elevation in status within the eyes of the government about the data centre industry in the UK. And, you know, this is something they've all been wanting for a really, really long time. They just to get, like I say, the credit they feel like they deserve, and just, you know, get a voice at the table on some, you know, policy decisions and stuff. So I was talking to Emma Fryer, the Associate Director of Data Centres at Tech UK, on this specifically, and she described it as like a seismic change in terms of how the sector is being perceived now. And yeah, she just said it's like proper recognition, the fact that the UK is a major data centre hub, which, you know, is a really good thing. There are, yeah, but as Tech UK acknowledged, though, all this kind of, oh, look, people are more aware of data centres, this could lead to sort of more scrutiny of how the sector operates, which I know a few operators might be a bit like, oh no, not more scrutiny, because they are already quite tightly scrutinised over energy use, how sustainable they are. But yeah, Emma sort of said, oh, she thinks it'll be more on things like how resilient is the sector? You know, if the UK economy is so dependent on data centres, what steps are operators taking to make sure that, you know, to protect against outages and stuff like that? And again, she said that can only be a good thing. Yeah, there might be more scrutiny to come with this, but I think the general consensus from the people I'm speaking to on this is that, yes, you might get more scrutiny, there might be more regulation as a result of that, but at the same time, that's an exchange for getting more influence in government, getting, you know, your voice heard on different matters. You know, it's a trade-off worth getting, really. So yeah, I'm hopeful it would lead to just like a greater awareness, like within government, but also the general public at large, like what data centers are. As we talked about on the podcast loads of times before, you know, there's a massive, quite acute skills crisis within the data center industry. You know, people just don't see it as a career path because so few people know what data centers are and what the wide range of career paths are in that bit of the industry and stuff. So yeah, it all sounds like quite promising and not really something that I've heard anyone say anything bad about. We'll see how long it lasts. You know, we could be on this podcast in 12 months time. I'm like, oh yeah, it was just a blip. COVID, everyone loved data centers. And after that, everyone forgot about them again. So we'll see.
Do you think, Caroline, that it'll be an area where there'll be future jobs growth, more people being employed in data centers?
Well, yeah, more jobs. But I think it's more the industry itself will be able to fill the jobs that they've got, hopefully, a lot more easily if people are more aware of, oh, if you're an engineer, you could go and work in a data center, or even just doesn't necessarily have to be tech roles, you know, security staff, you know, sales, marketing, sales jobs and stuff like that within the data center sector as well. It's just not having, people aren't aware that an industry exists, even if they've got skills that could cross over into it, then just not going to look for jobs there, are they? So the industry has got an abundance of jobs that need filling, but it's just trying to make people aware of that. That's the heart of the issue, really.
That's quite secretive, you've said before.
Well, and it works in the operator's favour to do that, because you know they never want to tell you whose kit is within their data centres, because they don't, in case it, you know, puts them at risk of something. Oh, you know, say for example, if Goldman Sachs' data in there, we'll ransack that place and off we go. You know, that kind of thing. So from a security aspect, they don't ever want to talk about it. But there is this kind of point of view that acting so secretly or behaving so secretly is sort of shooting the industry in the foot, because like I said, no visibility of what you do or anything like that. And it's like, oh, we can't attract staff. Well, you know, do you think the two are related?
Yeah, like can't be what you can't see. The same as, you know, like the well-known quote from like the women in tech sector.
Yeah, exactly. So but yeah, it's interesting to me, because I've been covering the data center industry for years and years and years, and it's just always been the same thing over and over again. People saying, oh, you know, we don't get recognition, it's hard to attract staff, nobody knows what our industry does. So for years and years, have people kind of making those complaints. And then suddenly, like, oh, this has all happened really, really quickly. Suddenly, all these changes that you've been calling for like, I don't know, decades or whatever, have suddenly started to come to fruition really, really quickly. So, yeah, so that's quite interesting to track.
What's your opinion on the possibility of increased regulation, but then at least some recognition from government?
Speculation. But, I mean, scrutiny on some areas would be good. Competitiveness. Some people have mentioned that, oh, that could be an area that might need taking into closer account, not within the sector itself, between operators, like one competing against the other, but in terms of making sure operators stay in the UK, which is something there's been talk about, they might leave because of Brexit, stuff like that, people taking data centres elsewhere because of that. But also things like this concept, which is touched on in the article, around carbon leakage, that because some of the policies in the UK around carbon emissions and carbon taxation and stuff are quite stringent, some operators are like, okay, we will have a site in the UK, but we'll put the majority of our investment in countries where maybe the rules around carbon taxation and things like that aren't quite so tough. So we lose investment because data center operators decide to put the bulk of their processing power in other countries because they've got better, maybe more lenient, shall we say, sort of tax strategies and things like that. So I think it could be good in that respect if the government's just more aware of that from a scrutiny point of view.
You know, the IT industry in general struggles a bit with diversity. It's getting there, but what about the data center industry specifically? Is it quite, you know, undiverse?
Yeah, quite in short, yeah. It's basically just dudes in suits everywhere you look, like whenever you go to conferences, and then there's just me. I'd stick out even more with my pink hair now, but yeah, I do I feel like I stick out like a sore thumb sometimes.
Thanks for that, Caroline. And Claire, you're working on a BCS-centric story.
It's a BCS analysis of some Office of National Statistics figures on diversity in the tech sector. So like I said before, they look into different underrepresented groups and they've split that into age, gender, disability and ethnicity. So for the purposes of the podcast, I'll just talk about ethnicity and gender, but in the analysis, I'm going to cover the other areas as well.
Sure.
But basically, it seemed to suggest that female IT specialists and BAME IT specialists have a higher level of education than some other groups, but are less likely to be in a position of responsibility than other groups. But the percentage of BAME IT directors was about 9%. And I think that the percentage of female IT directors was 13%. So in those sort of like high level positions, there are fewer female or BAME IT professionals than white directors or male directors, despite the fact that they are more highly qualified. But I think it was found for females, those degree or higher level qualifications aren't always necessarily in like a tech background. So it might be that even though that they are qualified to a high level, they aren't necessarily qualified in a tech related degree.
Okay.
Which I guess might, you know, I don't know how unusual that is, considering that a lot of women say that they sort of fell into tech. You know, they weren't necessarily aiming to be in a tech role, but somehow along their career, they ended up in a tech-based role. That seems to be, you know, like quite a common anecdote from women in tech. So, yeah, I don't know if that's representative. Who knows? Overall, in the tech sector, about 17% of IT specialists were women, which is a percentage that's only changed by about 1% in the last 5 years. And there were 18% of technology specialists were BAME, which is something that's only changed by about 2% over the last 5 years.
Mm.
So.
And both of those numbers are arithmetical genius here. Are kind of approaching 20. There's that whole thing about the 20-80 rule. That does seem like a stubborn lack of equality.
Yeah, and it's not as though there are a lack of initiatives that are trying to, you know, like get more diversity into the tech sector or make it more accessible and make it more friendly to people who aren't white, middle-aged, middle-class men, basically. Mm. But, you know, that's the reality that I read about so often that it doesn't shock me anymore, but it's obviously disappointing.
And it seems like it's significantly worse than the data center arena.
There are some statistics on different roles and which are more popular with women or Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups, which I did write about in more detail, but now cannot find. So you'll have to go and actually read the analysis to find out a bit more about that. But yeah, obviously that varies between region, role and industry. So, you know, it seems that the manufacturing sector is not the most diverse when it comes to IT specialists. There were very few IT specialists who were women or who were BAME in the manufacturing sector, from what I read, if I remember it correctly.
On the topic of diversity, I just wanted to kind of close the podcast by just flagging Cliff Saren's leader in this week's Computer Weekly e-zine issue, which is about technology CEOs speaking up for race equality.
Oh, good.
So Antonio Neri from HPE, Tim Cook from Apple, Satya Nadella from Microsoft, Jeff Bezos from Amazon are all sort of cited in Cliff's leader. And Cliff finishes his leader by saying, these corporate leaders are calling on their employees, their customers, the software development and partner communities to come together to make a difference. They are certainly not civil rights leaders, but in this topsy-turvy, highly connected, technologically driven world, their common message has a global reach. And maybe, just maybe, it can help make a difference, which I thought was very well expressed by Cliff. It's a good leader.
Mm.
And listeners can find that in the e-zine, which is always downloadable from the Computer Weekly homepage. I know we often talk about the e-zine on the podcast, and maybe they're thinking, where do we get this e-zine? We can get it from the homepage of Computer Weekly and sign up for it and things like that. Sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this week in the heat. So on this occasion, it just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
No worries, thank you.
Thank you very much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you very much to you for listening. Stay safe. Bye.
Bye. Bye.